Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Heart of Sports with Jason Springer and Jeff Cohen, powered by Elecki 25. We are thrilled to join you on WWDB 860M and 975 HD2, part of the Beasley Media Group, ready to help you move into the weekend, talking about all the news in the world of sports. He's called over 10 different sports and huge events, from the World Series to the Masters, the Olympics, bowl games, all-star games, and is the lead hockey announcer for NHL on ESPN and ABC. We're thrilled to get some time with announcer Sean McDonough. Sean, thanks so much for some time.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be with you guys.
I have no idea when you find time between all the things that you're calling there. Jeff and I were fascinated at your start, actually. For years, we did a minor league show in addition to this, and you're somebody who at Syracuse got your start with some minor league games. Talk about your time with the Syracuse Chiefs.
Yeah, it was really probably the most important thing that happened to me, one of the most important things on the career path, because when I was at Syracuse, the student station, WAER, had the rights to broadcast the minor league baseball team in town's games, the Syracuse Chiefs, as you said, who were the AAA team, top farm team for the Toronto Blue Jays. So students who wanted to stay for the summer and do the games, you'd do an audition tape or two the beginning of the year. The beginning of the season, the students who did the games the year before did the games like in April. And then the student management of the station and the team, the general manager of the team, Tex Simone, his son John, picked who they thought were the two or three people who should stay for the summer and do it. So I was very lucky. I won the audition my sophomore year in college and did the game sophomore, summer, junior, after my junior year and after my senior year. I wouldn't have been able to keep doing it because I wasn't a student anymore. And then the games actually left the student station, went to a commercial station in town, and the team asked me to stay and do the game. So, you know, basically by the time I got out of school, a few months after I got out of school at Syracuse, I had done about 400 minor league games, which, you know, was a huge head start.
You know, Sean, a lot of us can trace back to college the roots of the things that we were most passionate about. There are so many people from Syracuse who ended up in your line of work. What is it about Syracuse that leads to the success of people like you, Mike Tirico, and so many others?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot to that, Jeff. And it's funny because I had lunch yesterday with Dick Stockton, who's out here in Arizona. And, you know, for a lot of us, Marv Albert and Dick Stockton and Bob Costas were the reason we went there. You know, and they went there. Marv went there because he idolized Marty Glickman, the legendary announcer for the New York Knicks and the New York Giants back when Marv was a kid. And Marv got to know Marty when he was a kid. So he went to Syracuse because Marty went there, even though we really didn't have a broadcasting program. You know, it's just that's where Marty went, so that's where I'm going to go. So, you know, as the guys started coming there, and women now, a lot more women, thankfully, now, because they want to do this. They want to be like Marv Albert, as I did, or Dick Stockton or Bob Costas. And, they, you know, they kind of almost built the program once they realized, wow, a lot of people are coming here to do this, and we really don't have that much of a program for them. Obviously, there was a communications program. So, you know, now there are very specific programs up there. There's the Newhouse Sports Media Center in the Newhouse Communications School, and a lot of that is very specifically about sports broadcasting. So, you know, it's really become the place to be now. And it was then, you know, it's the curriculum up there is great. But I think a lot of it, you know, and I'm sure you guys would agree with this, 90 whatever percent of what Marv Albert needed or Bob Costas needed or Mike Tirico needed to be those guys, they were born with. You know, I go up there and I see, you talk to these kids now, and they're so smart and they're so talented. You know, they're broadcasting games and they've had very little training at it. So, you know, a lot of this, I think, is natural talent, and it's instinctive that, you know, it can be tweaked. Right. But the biggest benefit, I think, of going to school there now with the great curriculum that has been built is also you get the opportunity to do things like I did in minor league baseball and stuff like that.
Well, you talk about being instinctive. One of the experiences you did not get at Syracuse was learning to call bobsledding and luge. I love the fact that you prepared for the Olympics by going down a trial run yourself. Can you talk about what it was like and the lesson you learned about learning and preparation and really immersing yourself in the sport to be able to call it?
Yeah, well, when I was at CBS, it was a long time ago now. You know, the first Olympics I did was in '92 in Albertville, France. And originally, I was going to do short track speed skating, and I think it was Merlin Olsen retired or left, and he was going to do bobs and luge. So, sort of at the last minute, they said, "Oh, never mind, you're going to do bobsled and luge, and it's a promotion, which it's going to get more airtime, at least theoretically."
As
So, I
long as
didn't
you
think
survive, as
about
long
it.
as you live through it.
Yeah, well, that's the thing to Jason's question about. So I went to Lake Placid, which is where the U.S. teams train in bobsled and luge. We were going to televise as part of, I think it was the old CBS Sports Spectacular, whatever, the trials. You know, like a month or two before the Olympics, they're going to have this competition and pick the team based on the U.S. trials. So spent a lot of time with the people who run the sport, you know, coaches, PR people, walking up and down the bobsled and luge runs and having them explain to me, you know, what makes a good luger? How do you luge? You know, what are the important things? Same thing with the bobsled. So we were doing this walk and they said, "You want to try the luge?" So, you know, I sure, why not? So it was really stupid, to be quite honest.
Did you go
And
head first or feet first?
no, I went feet first. Yeah. Head first is that's a different form of luge, which I don't believe was in the Olympics when I did it. You know, I don't know if it is now too. I think that's skeleton, right?
Yeah,
But the
skeleton.
but anyway, there and the part of what made me do it was there were little kids there doing it. You know, there were like 10-year-old kids that are the little helmets and look, they're doing it. So, but they were also starting from, you know, 2/3 of the way down this icy slope. So the basic things they told me, and I'll try to make this brief, which I've already demonstrated I'm not good at, but they said you want to lie flat on your back because if you lean forward, then and your weight comes off the back of the sled, it's like a car that doesn't have enough weight when it's on ice or snow, and it starts the back of the sled will start the fishtail. And it really was like a toboggan. You know, you're lying on your back, so the runners are between your feet. Your feet are outside the two runners. And if you wanted to turn to the left, you'd push in with your right foot and it turns, you know, the runner's like, okay, that's pretty simple. And you need to steer into the turn. Like here comes a turn to the left. So you need to push in with your right. That's what make the thing go to the left. But what they don't tell you when you're lying flat on your back is you don't see the turns coming. And then you kind of go straight up into the turn and almost crash. And then your knee pad goes under your knee. And every time you hit another wall, your kneecap's hitting the wall. And that wasn't fun after a while. So I started cheating, right? Oh, I have to sit forward because I have to see this turn coming so I can steer into it. But then you start doing the fishtail and you're really not controlling the thing. What they left out was these losers memorize the course. So they know here comes the left-hand turn. Well, I didn't know. I had been walking up and down this thing for about an hour. So yeah, there were a lot of crashing into walls, a lot of pondering what would be the best way to get off this thing. You know, could I make myself maybe intentionally crash? And then I remember having the thought I had just signed to do the World Series for CBS, and I was going to be the youngest person who ever done the World Series on national TV. And I'm thinking, my obituary is going to be he never made it to the World Series. You know, so but I did learn. I learned a lot about, and I had a great appreciation for the courage it takes to do it, the speed at which they go, because I was going a lot slower than these world-class competitors, but it was also terrifyingly fast.
You know, you're in a much warmer place than we are right now, but let's start with winter sports because that's one of the things we wanted to have you on talking to talk about, which is hockey. You started by calling beanpot games. Can you tell us what that was like? Those rivalries to the outside world, if you're not a college hockey fan, you don't really understand the depth of intensity there is to
Yeah,
those
that's
games.
a
What
great,
was
that
it
was
like
just
to
the word
you?
I was going to use too, Jeff, is the intensity of it. You know, for those who don't know, you know, it's the Beanpot is the first 2 Monday nights in February. It's the four Division I Boston college hockey schools, Harvard, BU, BC, and Northeastern. And they play a tournament. You know, there's two games on the first for, Monday night, the two teams that win playing the championship game the following Monday night, and the two teams that lose playing the consolation game. So Yeah, it was awesome. And back in the early days when I started doing it, I think almost the entire time that I did it was in the old Boston Garden. So, it was even more intense because of just the proximity of everybody to the ice. And one of the few good things about the old garden was that it had one aisle that went all the way around, kind of at the top of the loges and before I think they called them stadium seats. So it was great, at an event like that where it's very social, right? All the alums of all the schools, and they're going to look for their buddies and say hi to their friends who went to one of these other schools. So it's just a great athletic and social event. And, kind of a in the city of Boston, if you went to those four schools, it was almost a must attend, but a lot of fun, so intense. And, doing that and doing Hockey East games for NESN and Channel 38 in Boston for a long time. You do hundreds of games. It's a great way to learn how to be a hockey announcer.
You're somebody who grew up in the 60s in Boston as a Bobby Orr fan, as a Bruins fan. Now you're the lead NHL announcer. You got to call your first game seven this past year, the Bruins against the Maple Leafs. I tell Jeff all the time, game seven in hockey is like my favorite thing. I think there's nothing like it, the handshakes at the end. Talk about what that was like to call that type of game and that type of rivalry.
Yeah, it was really cool. And, because for a lot of reasons, A, that it was the Bruins, I'm not going to lie about that. Growing up as a Bruins fan, dreaming about doing playoff games that would involve the Bruins. And I didn't even know that was my first game seven. So your research is better than my remembering my own life
Well, you've
experiences.
done others for other sports, but I
Yeah, but I
from
didn't know that was the first one in hockey. But not, now that I think about it, I'm not going to, I'm sure you've checked it out and you're right. So, and we were very lucky later in these same playoffs that in the most recent playoffs to have a game seven of the Stanley Cup final. But yeah, that was incredible because there were so many, any game seven has its own, to borrow Jeff's word again, intensity. And, it's the ultimate, right? You win and you go on and you lose and your season's over. So but in the with these two teams, I mean, it was Toronto, the team that just can't win in the playoffs, and in particular in the last two decades when they've really struggled to win a series, it's a lot of times it's been the Bruins, and sometimes it's been heartbreaking losses to the Bruins. So, and then in the case of the Bruins, they had the historic exit the year before, where they set the league record for the most wins and the most points in any regular season in the history of the league, and then they lost in the first round in a game seven to the Florida Panthers. So, and here we go again. Now they're in, they had the lead in the series. All of a sudden they're in a game seven. It's in overtime. And so, I mean, and that made it even that much better, right? I mean, it's not only it's game seven, but now it's overtime, which to me is like the ultimate pressure. So, and I had said I've been on a pregame show. The ABC affiliate did a pregame show before the game aired, and Duke Castiglione is one of the sports anchors on Channel 5 in Boston. His dad, Joe Castiglione, is a legendary baseball broadcaster I work with. Worked with Joe, just retired after a Hall of Fame career, and he asked me, "What do you think is going to happen?" I said, "Well, I think the Bruins are going to win it on a late goal by David Pastrnak," which actually, it's just kind of a lucky guess, but he wound up scoring the goal in overtime. And then, the fun part about this business is the spontaneity of it, right? That you only get to do it once, so either you nail the call or you don't. And I was very thankful that the response to it was really positive, that it was a big moment, and that Ray Ferraro and I and our crew, hope, most people have seen, thought we captured it pretty well.
When there's a player on the ice in a game seven, you know that there's that additional pressure, or you assume there is. For somebody in your position, you know that you're calling a game seven. Is there an additional pressure? Does it get into your head ever? And you sit there and go, there's going to be this moment. I have to be prepared for this moment. Or is it that it just flows at this point?
Yeah, I don't consciously remember Jeff feeling that way. Like, oh my gosh, this is overtime, and now, you better be on it, or don't blow it, or whatever. I just think you're so caught up in what's happening, making sure you're on top of all these storylines, right? Because, the game's the game. In hockey, something can happen so fast. It's very one of the things I learned when we got back in the NHL 4 years ago is how much faster the game was than when ESPN had last been in the NHL, I think 17 years before. So, back in the old days, guys carrying the puck up the ice, and you could look down at your notes, or if you couldn't remember his number, you could, look down and, oh yeah, he's number 18 is John Smith. You can't do that anymore because it just goes too fast. If you look down for 1 second, there is a penalty. There's a big check. There might be a goal while you look away. So calling the play is the most important thing because at any moment, any of those things could happen, right? A huge save that keeps the game going, a penalty that puts a team on a huge power play, the game-winning goal. So you can't get too much in the middle of, and no team has ever done this 2 years in a row, like the Bruins were about to do. And there was a lot of speculation about, well, if they lose, Jim Montgomery is going to be fired, even though he had like the second best first 2 years of the regular season of any team in NHL history. So, you got to kind of, those are more the things I think I was thinking about, honestly, like, okay. And then overtime didn't go along for very long. So we really didn't have to do that for very long because, Pasternak's goal came pretty quickly.
All right. Well, I'm going to segue you to something because you're partially responsible for my co-host crying at one point.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So, Jason, I'll let you take it
Can
from
I
here.
guess you're either a Michigan grad?
Nope, that's Jeff.
No, I'm a Michigan
Irish
grad,
fan.
but
Nope, not a Pirates fan.
okay, I'm trying to think what other calamities
Oh,
for sports.
Joe Carter.
Joe Carter or Phillies? Well, I should have known, right? You guys are the
Okay,
Phillies.
so here's the thing. My dad fell asleep, and I woke him up because we had tickets to Game 7 if the Phillies came back here. And I said, "Dad, they've got one more out. We're coming back." And he wakes up. He watches Mitch Williams throw the pitch. Joe Carter hits the home run. My dad says, "Welcome to being a Philadelphia sports fan," and went back to bed. So your call lives in my brain as a scarring moment of my Philadelphia
Yeah,
fandom. You
don't
nailed
kill
the
the
call.
messenger. That's always my message to people who have been on the wrong side of things that
Yes.
I've called is don't kill the messenger.
Yes.
We have nothing to, people who believe in the announcer jinx. I really wish that that was true because I would have the betting app and I would be the wealthiest man in on the planet. I would be wealthier than Elon Musk, who I just read today is now worth $400 billion. If we could actually control things. But
You
I
nailed
had
the
a guy in
call.
Pittsburgh. I was speaking at Pitts in Pittsburgh, and it wasn't long after the Sid Bream game seven that the Pirates blew. They're up 2-0 in the bottom of the ninth of game seven and lost the Atlanta Braves. Francisco Cabrera got the hit, and Sid Bream scored the run by that much. And a guy came up to me at this event in Pittsburgh, an older gentleman, and he said, "You were a part of the worst moment of my life." And I said, "Well, if losing a baseball game is the worst moment of your life, you had a hell of a life. Like,
He
where do I
did.
sign up for your life?"
See, I didn't say you ruined my life, but you did shape
No.
my sports
I
fandom.
cost you game seven, though.
Oh, yeah,
Believe me,
it's
I
all
would have
your
been
fault.
happy with game seven.
See,
The Joe Carter thing, people always ask me a lot, well, where this call or that call, or which moments were the most, impactful, the ones you remember the most. And that was huge, but it would have been bigger, obviously, if it was game seven. Because even if they had lost, Toronto had lost, they still had a game seven.
It's game seven.
So,
I
but it was
did
only the second time the World Series had ever ended
on a
on a
walk-off.
home run.
I know.
Right? You know,
I
Bill
remember now.
Mazeroski was the other one. That's when you know you're lucky because at the time, not too long ago, it might still be true, I don't know. The Major League World Series had only ended on a home run twice, and the College World Series, I did the only one at the time. Warren Morris, who later played for the Pittsburgh Pirates for LSU, hit a home run bottom of the ninth against Miami, walk-off home run. And the shot that sticks with me forever is he was running around the bases and jumping up and down the places going crazy. And we were laying out, which every broadcaster should do in a moment like that, was Alex Cora was the shortstop for the University of Miami, who was literally spread-eagled face down in the dirt. When he became the manager of the Red Sox, he said to me, "You're the guy." I said, "Yeah, I know what you're going to say. Yep, I called that, but again, don't blame the messenger."
I wanted to ask you about that, laying out. How do you know when to let the moment breathe and when to add your words and commentary to it so that we as the audience can get the full feeling of what's going on?
Yeah, I think we just had this the other night as we were speaking. Our group, college football group, did Clemson and SMU, and the ending was spectacular. And, SMU scored a touchdown. I think it was with 16 seconds to go, kicked the extra point, looked like overtime. And then Clemson got a big kickoff return, one pass, again, field goal range, kick a 56-yard field goal at the buzzer. So, you say it, and I think what I said, it's good. And then Clemson wins the ACC, whatever, and then stop, right? Describe it. Put it as briefly as you can into its significance, and then stop talking, especially in this day and age where the audio and the video are so great, you know, the sounds and the pictures. And there's nothing that we can say that's going to be as good as that. Now, I think the exception is, you know, I always continue to watch the monitor. And if something happens on the screen during the celebration that needs, you know, who is that? You know, oh, that's the owner of the team who maybe people don't know. Then I think there are times you need to jump back in. But if it's just players jumping on top of each other and the coaches shaking hands and the crowd going crazy, you know, to me, it's almost egotistical to keep talking, because all it really means is you want yourself to be a part of this when you really shouldn't be, right? You want your voice to be on this when they play it back, when you really shouldn't be.
You know, Sean, we often have people on the show to talk about how they use the platform that they have to better society and what the history is of why they have that passion. You have that passion, obviously, because of your father. Can you talk to us a little bit about the golf tournament and the reason that you do that?
Yeah. Well, thank you for asking. It's, my dad was a great sports writer, obviously, legendary sports writer, particularly in Boston. And he's also known nationally for being the first information man. You know, he was the first newspaper writer who went on TV. You know, he was the original Adam Schefter or Woj or Peter King or all those guys. You know, it's become an industry. Right when my dad died, Peter King was at my dad's funeral. And when I was walking out, he said, "Well, I got hired to be on TV. The first person I call is your dad to say thank you, because if he didn't do this and do it well, you know, this probably wouldn't even be a thing." So, you know, really proud of everything that my dad accomplished in his professional career. But, you know, the reason that we had his wake in the Boston Garden, the TD Garden, when he died, because the Bruins ownership, which owned the building, called us and said, "We think this is going to be the only place in the city big enough to have this." And, you know, we were fortunate that the teams were out of town at the time. But it was really because of the kind of person he was. You know, he was very philanthropic, never said no to a great cause. And so, you know, I think the best way to honor that part of him is to mirror what he did. So we've had a charity golf tournament, celebrity golf tournament now for several years, 20 years, really. But for the last 8 or 9 years, I guess it is now, I always lose track. You know, we have it to raise money for cardiac amyloidosis research, which is the rare heart disease that killed my dad, which we didn't know that even had until they did an autopsy, because his doctors were very perplexed about why he died at 67. So the foremost research in the world for cardiac amyloidosis is being done in Boston at Brigham Women's Hospital. And so there's that connection too. So we have a celebrity golf tournament. A lot of really nice celebrities come. Charles Barkley comes every year, and Bill Murray's been several times. And, you know, this year we had Joe Buck and Donnie Wahlberg and Ray Bourque. And, you know, it's just kind of a who's who of celebrities. And we've raised a lot of money this past year. We, you know, with just a party the night before and the golf tournament the next day, this past year we raised $757,000. And it's really, you know, significant amount of money for these research teams. Because part of the problem is when the government thinks, not enough people have this, you know, it stinks that people are dying from it, but, you know, it's, we can't really give a lot of money to it because it's, there's more people that have this disease or that syndrome or whatever. And I get it, but so it's really meaningful. And then you meet the patients whose lives have been saved or extended. You know, who you thought when you saw them at the event a year or two ago, they probably weren't going to make it to the next year. And now they're there and they're, I'm going to be emotional, but they're healthier and they come over and thank you. We had one young man come up to me after the event a year and a half ago and said, "My mom is still alive because of your golf tournament." You know, so a lot more important than ball one and strike one. And, you know, that's a power play goal and that sort of thing. You know, it's, we had a gentleman speak a couple of years ago at the event, and Sean Riley, and he was in really rough shape. Remember, Michael Ruzzioni and I at the event the night before had to help him up on the stage. And and he gave a wonderful speech. He was in Dubai. He was told the foremost people in the world who have what he likely has are in Boston. You need to go to Boston to see Dr. Rodney Fogg. So he spoke, and I thought, oh, this poor guy, you know, it's too late. And then, 2 years later, I was asking Dr. Falk about, you know, do we have a good speaker for this year? Because I always want people to hear from people who benefited from the research and are getting treated. And he said, yeah, there's this gentleman. And he said, and Sean Riley's doing really well. I thought, in my mind, I thought, Sean Riley's still alive? He said, yeah, he's doing great. So he came, he looked much better. I mean, nobody had to help him up on the stage. And he walked up there and he talked about how much better he's been doing these last 2 years, and he didn't think he'd still be alive. And he said, and thanks to you people, since I was here 2 years ago, I met the love of my life and we're getting married. So
that's amazing.
It's important.
The opportunities that you provide people, and we talk about using the platform and what it means to you, but what's it mean to you to see the goodness of the people who help? Who give for no other reason than they see it's the right thing to do, or they believe in you, or they believed in your dad, or they believe in the cause.
Yeah. And it's all of that, in all honesty, Jason. You know, it's some of them are just my friends who know what's important to me, and it's, you know, and they want to help. And then other people have a connection to the cause. And then, you know, these celebrities get pulled everywhere. And, you know, I asked Charles, you know, would you just come once, you know? And then he came and he gets invited to all of these, and he does very few of them, but he understands the importance of the cause. He likes the people involved. He's an amazing guy. I mean, he comes back to Boston Golf Club every year, and he remembers the names of the bag drop people and the guys in the pro shop and the waitresses in the dining room. You know, it's, and he meets more people than anybody I know, you know? So, you know, and you're just so grateful to them for doing it. And, but I think when they get there, A, it's a lot of fun. It's, you know, Jay Billis one time, who doesn't like anything or anyone, said, I'm kidding, said, this is the best combination of classy but fun, you know, and it's a great golf course. The hotel's awesome, the Boston Harbor Hotel. You know, it's a first class event, but it's, I think people realize that, you know, when they see the doctors talk, hear the doctors talk, see the patients whose lives are being saved, see their families who have more time. I would kill for one more day with my dad, you know, 5 more minutes with my dad. And to know that we're helping these people spend more time with their loved ones is awesome, I think, to all of us. So it's a group effort, and it's fun. It's a tremendous amount of work. It's amazing how many pieces go into these things. And my sister, Erin, really does it with me, and we're not good delegators. You know, cause everything has to be just so, but, it's a labor of love, and we're going to keep doing it until they find a cure. And I think they will, and hopefully sooner rather than later.
What's it like to know that a lot of these people are doing this because of their love and their respect for your dad?
Yeah, it's really emotional. You know, those are the two things, I think that are most emotional. When people, you know, we started this tournament before, when my dad was still alive, we started a tournament. I wanted to do something. Billy Andrade and Brad Faxon, who are the two great professional golfers from Rhode Island, they started a foundation in Rhode Island and southeastern Massachusetts. I used to go play in their golf tournament, and they would raise a lot of money, and then they'd give out money to children's charities in southeastern Mass and Rhode Island. And they had a little board. People, organizations would apply to them for a grant. They'd go through it. What are you going to do with the money? Okay, we're inclined to give you the money, but you already have $5 million in the bank. This place on the corner that's, you know, trying to help kids get out of addiction or whatever, they have $20,000 in the bank. You know, it's, you know, they would identify what they thought were the most important causes. So we, with their considerable help, mirrored that for several years, and we wound up giving out about $3 million to 129 children's charities around Massachusetts. Early in that, my dad died, so I think the first or second year. So we dedicated everything to that after, you know, in memory of my dad and to carry on his legacy of charity. And so about the fifth or sixth year, we took a celebrity picture with the celebrities who'd been to all six, I think it was at that time. And it was Dick McPherson, the old football coach at Syracuse I worked for, was like a second dad to me, coached the Patriots after that. Eric Crouch, who won the Heisman Trophy, who was a friend. Billy Packer, the late, great Billy Packer, who was the first one to send back the "Yes, I'm coming" every year from Charlotte. myself, obviously, and Bob Cousy. So we have the golf, we finish 1 year, and my sister grabs me and says, we have a problem with Bob Cousy. It's like at the little cocktail and the awards thing after. And I thought, oh God, something bad happened. Did he get hit by a golf ball or something? She said, well, he was very emotional. He doesn't think he can come anymore. And he loves coming to this event because he loves dad. You know, he loved dad. And I said, well, what's the matter? And she said, well, his wife, Missy, at the time, had been battling Alzheimer's for a while. He said, and it's gotten to the point where he can't leave her at home, you know. So I thought, okay, you know, I totally understand. I said, what happened today? What did he do today? She said, he flew his daughter up from Florida for the day because it was important for him to be here and to continue to honor dad. So, you know, guys who played when Bob Cousy played aren't awash in cash. So, you know, to fly his daughter up for the day to sit with his wife and her mother so that he could come to the golf tournament because it was important to honor my dad. It says a lot about Bob. It says a lot about how people felt about my dad. But, you know, it also says a lot about athletes from that era, right? Because I'm not sure a lot of today's athletes would have the same kind of heart about that sort of thing.
You know, Sean, just from this interview, you mentioned so many people that, you know, are jaw-dropping people in sports. Do you ever sit back and just go, wow, look at the journey that I've been on. Look at the people that I've met. You know, you work with people like Mark Messier and you talk about Bob Cousy and all the people that you were. Do you ever just sit back and go, wow, look at the people I get to spend time with?
It's the best part of the whole thing. It really is, right? Life would be pretty dull and not very fulfilling if we were here by ourselves, right? And I think any experience you have in life, whether it's personal, professional, whatever it is, it's really ultimately about the people you share it with. And I think about that every day. You know, I wake up every day and thank God for the life that I have and have had. And, you know, it hasn't all been happy or, you know, there's been a lot of heartache along the way, like everybody's life. But, you know, when I look back and add it all up and I don't have to look back, I'm just today think about, as we're talking in a week, I'm going to go do the first college football playoff game on a college campus, and it's going to be at Notre Dame. And, as someone who was raised by a nun who was a sister of Notre Dame who loved Notre Dame, you know, it would be cool anyway, given all the history. But, you know, and to your point, Jeff, the thing I love most about doing college football every week is I love the people I do it with. Greg McElroy is a great guy. Molly McGrath is like my sister. You know, Scott Johnson, our director, Phil Dean, our producer, our camera crew. It's a family atmosphere, which doesn't always happen in our business. So, you know, when I worked with Billis and Raftery for all those years, you know, doing college basketball, yeah, we did a lot of big games, a lot of big Mondays in the good old Big East. But the best part was I was going to go do it with two of my best friends and have a lot of laughs before, during, and after. So that's what life's all about. And, you know, again, to your point, Jeff, sitting here telling these stories and talking about these people, you know, to know how blessed I am and have been and will continue to be to have people like that as my friends, and not because they're celebrities. I have a lot of friends who aren't celebrities who are wonderful people too. But, you know, but to know that there are people in that stature of life who are, you know, who are celebrities and are revered by people for their athletic achievements or their, you know, work in movies or TV, and to know what good people they are. And I really am blessed.
Well, it's a good thing you're calling the Notre Dame game, because I sent Jeff the get-in price is kind of crazy for it. But
yeah, I've had some friends ask me, can you help me with tickets? I said, no, and chances are you're not going to want to go once you see how much it's going to cost you to get tickets.
Not at all.
And last I saw, the cheapest tickets were $1,200, and that was a few days ago, so it's probably even more than that.
Yeah, that was the Jeff always enjoys those text messages from me where I send him pricing of what it is. Sean, how can people give if they want to support the organization so that we can share it too?
Oh, wow. If you Google, there's a bunch of ways, and off the top of my head, I always forget the more direct route, but if you Google SeanMcDonoughClassic.org, It'll take you to the link. Or if you went to Brigham and Women's Hospital's giving page and searched, there is a link specifically to the Sean McDonough Celebrity Golf Classic Fund, which goes directly to Dr. Falk and his research team. And
Wow.
that's the thing that I love about, I was a little worried, when we partnered with the hospital. One of the things I love about our event, it's one of the things I love about the V Foundation, is 100% of the money goes. When the hospital approached, we said, well, we can help you with all the logistical things that you and Aaron don't necessarily have the time for. And I said, well, I don't like that guy. I don't want it. I like being able to tell people, hey, no one gets paid. This is an all volunteer army. And they said, well, everybody on the events team at the hospital, those positions are endowed. So if we're not taking money out of any event to pay us, we're already paid if we don't do any events. And the V Foundation is the same way. So, I can tell people if they do go to any of those links and find it, 100% of it goes right to this research fund.
Well, we'll
And
make.
it's amazing. It used to be, you got it. It was very hard to diagnose. It was very hard to treat. And like my dad, you died unless you got a heart transplant. And my dad didn't get a heart transplant in part because they didn't know he had it until after he died. And they did the autopsy. So now there are much better diagnostics. There are much better treatments, but still, really, the only way to cure it is to get a heart transplant. Matt Millen, who you guys are well aware of, he had the same disease my dad died. He had cardiac amyloidosis. He very nearly died from it. He was in the hospital for a long time. I think it was 80 days, 80 plus days, waiting for a heart. And it had to be a certain, Matt's a big guy, so it had to be a particularly, I don't know the details of that part, but they're making a lot of progress. So, and they're, at the very least, they're extending people's lives, and the quality of life during that extension is much better than it used to be. So, we're making progress, but we want the cure, and it's going to happen.
Well, we'll make sure to share it on our social platforms and keep talking about it. And we can't
Appreciate it.
thank you enough
Yeah,
for
it's
the
an
time.
important cause. All these causes are important. Charles says that every year. Charles always says, I come here every year to support this disease, help this disease I can't even pronounce. And I'm sure you can hear Charles saying that.
It's terrible.
It is a mouthful. I usually call it CA, but it's yeah, it's really important, and I really appreciate you guys giving me a chance to talk about it.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk about it, using your platform the way you do, and we can't wait to
Oh,
hear
you
what your
made me
next call
cry. I
is.
didn't anticipate when I came on here with you two nice guys that I was going to get a little weepy, but
It's all Jeff's
well, I
fault.
guess this is Jason's revenge for
Yeah,
you calling a game that
see,
made him cry.
hey, I
now
like to
we've.
cry. I couldn't fall asleep the other night. It's V week as we're talking. So I turned the TV on and they have the 30 for 30 about Jim Valvano and the great run that 83 Wolfpack team made. And then after that, they went to a thing about another documentary about the speech and everything that it took to get
Yeah.
Jimmy there on that night. I'm sure you guys have seen it. But the old thing about, every day you should laugh, you should cry, you should think. I cry a lot, but and I'm glad I do.
Well,
It's a good.
we're glad we can help give you a full day. We really appreciate the
It's been
time.
a very full day. We've done all of those things
Hey.
in the relatively limited time that we've been together.
Thanks so much for the time, Sean. You have a great one.
Oh, my pleasure. Let's do it again. This was fun.
Fun to talk to Sean. Man, has he seen some things, especially that CFP leading game last week.
He's going to get to do what, Notre Dame, Indiana?
It's a good thing he's getting to go there because I told you those prices are insane.
Well, the good news is he's actually going to see two teams that aren't going to change coaches this year.
Is that a rarity?
Right?
That's a rarity at this point in college sports, right? Coaching carousel in full swing?
Yeah, well, with Bill Belichick deciding that college is the place to go, it appears that it is in full swing now.
Surprise you?
Yeah. I mean, especially, a guy in his 70s who's what, 16 wins or so away from the all-time record, who there are going to be what, at least half a dozen, if not 8 to 10 openings. And for some reason, nobody wants to hire him. Like
Yeah.
you got to think that if all the rumors came out about this, that somebody, if they wanted him, would have like got their people to get in touch with his people and said, hey, by the way, we're interested, hang in there.
Well, he does have that chance, technically, for everything he said. He does have a clause that if he terminates the deal without cause to leave for an NFL job before June 1st, UNC owes him $10 million. But that drops to $1 million on June 1st of 2025.
So how are you going to recruit?
Well,
now that it's coming.
Well, he's got our guy Mike Lombardi there as his general manager to help.
Well, that's general manager.
He's got $13 million in annual revenue share dedicated. He's got a $16 million budget for coaches and strength and conditioning. And he's going to sell himself as the guy that's going to prepare you for the NFL having six Super Bowl rings.
Okay. And every single coach, you can say whoever is going to be there. The general manager is not.
I don't necessarily think it's going to work.
Hold on. Let me finish. The general manager isn't the guy going out and recruiting. The coaches, positional coaches, are the people that do the initial recruiting, and then it's the head coach. If you're telling me that means everybody else knows, because unless you're in the know,
we know I'm not in the know.
The fact is now every other coach knows that he has this out before they snap the first ball for next season. Right,
you'd be telling kids that when you're recruiting them, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That's not even dirty recruiting tactics.
No,
that's... if I'm a coach at school X, and the kid and his parents say, "Well, you know, I'm talking. How do you compete with the fact that I'm going to go play potentially for Bill Belichick, one of the greatest coaches of all time?" And he tells me he's going to get ready. My response is, "Well, you don't know he's going to be there. For some reason, he's decided to put an out in his contract." Before you get to campus.
Should I tell the listeners my snarky response I gave to you on text with the...
What was that?
Will he display the Duke Mayo's Bowl trophy along with his Super Bowl rings together?
I love the
Mayo Bowl. I want to see him dumped in Mayo. Because college, you know, that doesn't happen in the pros. It's not like they're going to put him down in the Pop-Tart machine and cook him. So.
Well, you know what? Who else had the over-under on how long it was going to take Jason to mention the Pop-Tart Bowl?
Look,
you must eat Pop-Tarts every day because you talk about the Pop-Tart Bowl.
I am very excited.
That's your mecca.
They announced the mystery flavor. They're bringing back cinnamon. I'm very excited for this.
Do you desperately want Rutgers to be in the Pop-Tarts Bowl?
They're not. They're in the rate.com bowl.
No, but if would you go? If they were in,
I don't go anywhere, but I would think about that.
Yeah,
exactly. I would think about that. But you know, I don't go anywhere.
Jason wants to eat the mascot.
there we go. That's the whole reason I'm rooting for what's going on. I mean, look, the carousel is spinning, and you've got a lot of guys going back to places. A guy you're pretty familiar with from Michigan, Rich Rod, goes back to West Virginia. That gonna work out?
Live long and prosper, buddy. Like that. I laughed so hard when I heard that. Where has he even been?
I think he was at New Mexico or something.
New Mexico, or was he just hanging out in Mexico?
I'll Google it. You keep talking.
I can tell you, the second they announced that hiring at Michigan, there wasn't anyone who thought that was a good idea.
He was the coach of Jacksonville State from 2022 to 2024.
Oh, good for him. Okay. Well, you know what?
Where he was. Just
have fun.
You think that's going to work out? Scott Frost returns to UCF. I mean, we saw Greg Schiano come back to Rutgers. You know, it's like, does it work when these guys come back for a second tour?
I guess we'll find out, won't we? I mean, in the area that era, I guess speaking would be helpful for me. But yeah, in the era of recruiting and NIL and transfer portal, I don't think you know until you know that these people can navigate this. I mean, especially Rich Rodriguez is not somebody who I anticipate is going to be able to handle the NIL and the transfer portal well.
You said the magic two words, transfer portal. So the transfer portal opened on Monday.
It blew up.
And you sent me a link. And of course, rather than reading the headline, I actually looked in the story and found a number for you.
Yeah,
1,537 people declared for the transfer portal on day one.
It doesn't matter now. It's just kids just enter the portal for entering the portal.
Is everybody just on one-year contracts now, basically? Is that where we are?
The answer is yes.
You know, you renew your contract for another season, you get picked up for another year, you move on and get a contract with someplace else. I mean, you see Lombardi's going to be the GM at North Carolina. Andrew Luck is coming back to be the general manager at Stanford. Like, is that where we are? We're just at contracts?
It's where we are, but I'm sure if you can find it, there have been episodes of our show where I have said the answer needs to be that they become paid employees with contracts that last for a period of time. Because otherwise, this is exactly what you're going to have, exactly what you said.
Is a one-year period a good period of time? Because that's where it seems like we are right now.
Then they shouldn't be affiliated with colleges.
I mean, that's
my feeling. I think that you can preserve the college football system and still have compensation for the student athletes, but it requires them to be student athletes, not people like. Do they even know who they're getting their diplomas from half the time? Do they care? And so that's it. They're like, you can have a couple things here. You can leave it the way it is if that's what you want to do, and then every year you have this mess. And eventually what that means is you're not going to have college coaches. College coaches are not going to be, the stress level for this is just going to be too high.
You can see it with some of the coaches as they go to their press conferences. You know, the fight
to
keep the players that they have, let alone recruit new players into the system and coach the game.
Starting isn't enough anymore to keep anyone.
In fact, starting is like the leading indicator to leaving. Because if you start at a smaller school, then the bigger schools will come and say, you're good to come play here. So it's catch 22.
Here's an example. I believe his name is Malik Murphy, who was the quarterback at Duke.
Why do you ask me these things without checking?
So the quarterback formerly at Duke,
okay,
who started his college adventure, I believe at Texas. And
it is Malik Murphy.
Yes. So he starts at Texas. He started his college career at Texas. That doesn't work out, so he goes to Duke. He excels at Duke, which, by the way, wouldn't anybody like a diploma from Duke? And decides that's not good enough, so now he's off to where is he going next year?
I don't know. He's in the transfer portal. Did he choose a school yet?
I don't know. But like,
he's in the portal. Yeah.
Everybody's now always searching for something better. The question is, what is the better that they're searching for? Are they searching for a championship? Are they searching for somebody who's going to coach them better than they're being coached now?
I'm concerned.
Is it just the quick dollar without a thought of your future? And by the way, I keep asking these questions. Is any of it related to making sure that you get an education?
No.
So that's my concern, is you have to...
No, people don't go in the transfer portal to find a school that will give them a degree they want. They go in the transfer portal to find a school that will give them the playing time that they want.
Right. So I think you have to find a way that you can legalize term contracts instead of 1 year. And by the way, it's not even just 1 year contracts. We had players like the guy at UNLV
who weeks.
In the middle of the season said, I'm out because I want to preserve another year to go somewhere else.
Well, that's one other thing I'd like to change. I'd like the transfer portal to open after the bowl games, so all the players don't decide not to play in.
Look at you agreeing with Lane Kiffin on something.
I never thought that would happen, but it's chaos. I mean, you have no idea who's going to play, who's going to go where, what's going to go on. You've got these teams that made it. I mean, are you? I know Michigan's not there, so you're not excited for anything. But are you excited for the college football playoff this year? Are you looking forward to it?
No.
You suck. Come on. But I
think that most people who go to a school like Michigan or one of the top 15, 20 programs, your loyalty is with your school. It's different than like pro football. I can watch any playoff game. I really need for college football kind of a rooting interest, even if I have to make it up in my head for that game.
You don't think
like Indiana versus Notre Dame, hate them both. I can't watch that game.
Okay, but you don't think it's cool that there's a game at Notre Dame at like these big stadiums?
No, I didn't say it's not cool. You asked me whether or not I'm going to watch it. I don't know if I can
you
watch
do a
it.
Sports
I need
radio
a
show.
Interest.
You need a sport. You do a sports radio show. Your rooting interest is to talk to me. Come on, let's do this.
So you want me to watch every college football playoff game? Would you like me to watch all of the ridiculous bowls too?
Please,
like where does this apparently allegiance to you stop?
Says
because
the guy.
Hold on, you got to let me finish here because if you're now going to put me in the position on the air, of telling me that you're going to guilt me into watching all of the sports events you watch in order to do the show, I will have no time to do anything.
I don't have
to
guilt you into anything. Who was texting me at 1 o'clock the other night about their fantasy football team? It wasn't me texting you about my fantasy football team.
Thanks to Brock Purdy, I won't be doing that again until next year.
So you can clearly change, because years ago, I would mention the word fantasy football and your eyes would glaze over. Why are we wasting our time? And here I am working late thinking, Jeff's sound asleep. He went
working
to bed.
Late. Which sporting events did you have on?
I put sporting events on to watch I'm working late. I appreciate when they're on, but I was up working, and I had texted you earlier, and you're like, I'm going to bed. And you had two players that definitely could have won you the game, and the touchdown to Ja'Marr Chase did it. I did not text you, figuring you fell asleep.
I did fall asleep.
And you woke up to check your fantasy stats.
No, so, I woke up and then did check.
So you can clearly change. So maybe you will start to watch more sports that your teams aren't in, because you've shown this tendency to adjust.
Yeah, but which teams for college sports am I going to watch? I need a rooting interest. I can root for Boise State.
I know you're not. Okay, I'll really look at the teams who are in. I know you're not rooting for Dabo at Clemson. I mean, you could root against Ohio State for Tennessee. Why does that hurt you?
I don't like Tennessee either. Sorry, people.
Actually, you might want Ohio State to win just so that they can keep Ryan Day there. Which, by the way, we forgot to mention that. Did you like light a candle in celebration that they're keeping him? That's like me wanting the Dallas Cowboys to keep Mike McCarthy forever.
No, if Ohio State wants to do stupid stuff, feel free to do stupid stuff. Because next year, we're having a bounce back year.
You're buying every quarterback in the league, and you've got a terrible schedule. You don't have to play anybody.
How badly do you want to have? See, so here's moments when I really want certain guests.
Okay.
I would love to have Kirk Herbstreit's son, or any son who goes to the rival of their school.
How would you handle that if Alex went to Ohio State?
I would be crushed.
I was going to say, would you be able to write that?
And I would know he hates me. That would be the line where I know my kid. Like, he could go anywhere else and I would be fine.
Like, Herbstreit's kid's getting a scholarship, so he's not going to have to write a check to
getting a scholarship behind a guy who's been getting paid $10.5 million.
You would have to actually write a check to the Ohio State University. Could you write those words out on a check without your handshaking?
No, I know I couldn't. That's where my parenthood would have to have been. But I don't have to worry about that. You do. Mine's done. So
I don't need to worry about that.
But you know, we did have somebody. We asked that question, and on this, as we approach this holiday season, I so wanted a better answer than we got
from.
You remember we had Amani Toomer on.
Yes.
And that was the situation, Michigan and Ohio State. No good answer.
He didn't give it to you.
It was quite a bummer.
Yeah.
Hey, but before we go.
Yeah, we got about a minute.
We spent a lot of time talking about the Yankees fan who was not immediately kicked out for the next game. Yeah. Kudos to the Lions ownership. Fan got in an argument with Matt LaFleur. Lions sent him an email, apparently said, tickets revoked, don't bother.
That didn't take much time either.
Wouldn't even talk to him.
Yeah.
That's the kind of ownership you do.
Yeah, look, I mean, you don't want your fans to reflect poorly on the other fans or the organization. Clearly that fan crossed the line, and good for Detroit for taking action on it.
Yeah, I just think that we need ownership that's willing to be responsible enough to not just the fans, but to the players and coaches and everybody in the organization. And to me, that showed a responsibility to everyone by taking decisive action, unlike the Yankees that needed to basically be cajoled into not letting them back. And I still don't know. Is that fan allowed back next season? Those guys that
thought
that
he only lost his ticket for that game. All right, that's going to be your last thought. My last thought is Matvei Mishkov is a Flyer.
No, your last thought this week should be you're happy that Scott Laughton is a Flyer.
Man, 4 goals in a game. That was fun to watch. Anything else?
What do you call that?
I don't know. It's not a hat trick.
No, I don't know. Hat trick plus one.
They were already out of their hats. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Make sure to join us next Friday night to help you start your weekend in style. Have a great one. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Operating engineers are the men and women that move mountains. And the Engineers Labor Employer Cooperative, ELEC, puts them to work. They create opportunities for the men, women, and union signatory contractors of Local 825, repaving our roads, keeping our homes bright and warm, and even building our favorite team stadium. We understand infrastructure. That's why ELEC and Local 825 are ready to get to work.